Hello again, Patrick Cox here, and we have another World in Words newsy pod, which takes the form of cartoon queen Carol Hills and me, displaying just how little we know about five language stories that were recently in the news. We've tried to avoid the obvious stories, which is another way of saying that what you're about to hear is deeply obscure. So get ready for some Tamil onomatopoeia, some gender talk, Carol's adventures in Gothenburg, and much, much more. All this brought to you by PRI, the BBC World Service, and WGBH in Boston. Okay, so here in the big studio is Carol Hills. Hi, Carol.
Hey, Patrick.
It's been a while.
It's been a while.
Where have you been?
Well, I have been away. I was away for about a week, and I was in Sweden.
Sweden.
And I was not in Stockholm. I was in the second largest city, the home of Volvo. English-speaking people call it Gothenburg. Swedes call it Göteborg.
Göteborg. Do they have meatballs there?
I think they do.
But you didn't have any?
I didn't.
Oh.
I didn't. I was, you know, I hardly ate. I mean, I was just kind of running around, but I mostly would stumble into a cafe at the end of the day and, you know, order whatever. I actually had some Greek food there one night.
Well, when in Gothenburg.
Yes. But I was there to do something totally opposite of being in Sweden, which there's an international book fair there every year.
Yeah.
And this year the focus is on African writers.
Mm.
So I was there as a way to interview a bunch of African writers in one setting. So it was kind of exciting.
And that is, in fact, story number five, is your experience of Swedish and the African languages, right?
Yeah, the Sweden is funny. You know, you get there, it's one of these, like, hyper-organized Northern European countries, and they're not going to let you get upset there. You know, you're in the tram stop. It's got a little marquee telling you how many minutes till the next tram gets there. So just everybody can just calm down. They know when something's going to happen. It was kind of interesting, and I was trying to get a hold of the language. Of course, everyone speaks English, and everyone's beautiful, by the way. Like, so beautiful, you just think, if they're all beautiful, is anybody beautiful? You know, oh, gosh, here's another beautiful woman comes walking toward me, and here's another very handsome Nordic man coming toward me. And it's like, how does it work? How do they discern?
Who gets to do the radio? You know what they say, face for radio, right?
Exactly. I don't know who's doing radio. It's just shocking. And I have to say, it's like sounds really kind of narrow-minded for somebody on an international show, but I'm thinking, how has this genetic pool maintained itself? I mean, there's still, you're in this place. Yes, it's kind of far north. Yes, okay. But they're all still pumping out those blonde, you know, blue-eyed kind of, you know, you just think, how is this going on? How does this keep going?
Meatballs.
I don't know. But the language is kind of hida hida hoda hida hoda, you know, and it's mm-hmm. kind of, it looks vaguely German.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of the words, I'd spent some time in German-speaking countries. Let me turn this off. Sorry, that's making a little ding ding. You've got a new message. Oh, be quiet. I don't care if you've got a new message. Just everybody be quiet. Let me just turn this off. Back to the language. Swedish, it looks kind of German, Germanic. It's clearly on that kind of trail. But then there were weird curveballs. Like, I would assume children would be kinder, but it was all barn. Barn
that's right.
This,
yeah,
barn
yeah.
that.
Well, it's very similar to Danish and Norwegian, or at least written. But just when you thought that Swedish was the same as Danish or that you could understand everything, they would throw in a word that, you know, was completely different. Their numbers are very different. Their words from 50, 60, 70 are very completely different in Swedish than from Danish.
Oh.
I think they make more sense in Swedish, actually. In Danish, they don't make an awful lot of sense. We would watch Swedish TV. In Copenhagen, you could watch either Danish or Swedish TV. You know, in those mm-hmm. days, there were like three channels to choose between or something. And Swedish TV was a bit better than Danish TV because they could buy more foreign stuff. But I had real trouble if anything was in Swedish. I mean, once it's spoken, it was very different.
Exactly. Yeah. It looks similar to a Germanic language or probably other Scando languages. But then when it's spoken, there's more like Korsvagen. There was a tram terminal that I would take a bus to every day. And I looked at it. It looks like Korsvagen, K-O-R-S-W-A-G-E-N. But it was Korsvagen. Something like
that. Right.
Because vegan.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of hee hee hee.
Yeah.
You know, I'd go into a store and they go hee hee.
Yeah. It's kind of like birdie up and down sing songy. Yeah. In a way that Danish most certainly isn't, nor is Norwegian.
Yeah. So it was kind of different. So it was fun, but I was there mostly to interview Africans. So it was in this funny thing. Like, And talking to Africans, they speak like 8 million languages apiece because they all have local languages and secondary languages and the language they were educated in. And
the
then
colonial
they were,
language.
The colonial language, the lingua franca, the language they speak now because they live somewhere else.
Right.
It goes on and on.
Right. And they probably picked up some Swedish as well.
Exactly. So,
but
it was very exciting.
Mm, that's great. Well, I did notice that there was a Swedish story. Well, just around about the time that you were there, the transport authority in Sweden had done. We've done stories about names in Sweden. The government doesn't like it when people use funny names or adopt funny names. And I think we'd done a story in a previous podcast, number 78, about a Swedish couple trying to name their kid Q, the letter Q. Well, this is the transport authority this time saying yay or nay to certain personalized number plates. Somebody tried to call their car, I guess that they were naming their car through the license plate, Lucifer. And this did not go down well. Other names that had been rejected were Sexy Boy, Vodka, and Badass. That is B-A-D-A-Z-Z.
What's weird is that the Swedes would have a problem with that because they're kind of hipster groovy on a lot of issues.
Mm.
So who cares what people name their kids?
Yeah, yeah. And they're also not a... it's not a very religious nation.
No. No, it's funny because that's a throwback. I guess you've done many more stories about this than I have, but the whole naming thing, a lot of countries are kind of uptight about that.
It's true, yeah. Yeah, and, well, the Norwegians too.
And Germans were. Yeah. But then there's some kind of throwback bad boy doghouse countries that were famous for, like Romania under Ceausescu was famous for everyone had to have a Christian name and all that. So, but I just don't understand when like governments have a role in naming. What?
Yeah, it's certainly a very un-American idea.
It's totally un-American to tell me what to name my kid.
Yeah, I mean, just think of all those poor kids in the 60s, what they got
all
names over
all those rainbows and, you know.
Yeah. Okay, well, on to story number four. And I think I know a lot of people read a piece in the New York Times Magazine over the summer by Guy Deutscher, which is... It was actually an excerpt from his book that has come out called Through the Language Glass. And this was the headline for the excerpt in the Times Magazine, Does Your Language Shape How You Think? Now, I'm not going to talk about that because there's been a ton of stuff on the blogosphere. I can stick some links up
there. I
even
saw books about it in Sweden.
Wow. Yeah. I mean,
in airports and bookstores. Yep.
Huge, huge issue right now. This is something that just comes up about once a decade among linguists. There was one little piece of it that I found very interesting, which was on genders. Deutscher used the example of a lot of European languages that have both masculine and feminine. And he picked German and Spanish as two languages where a noun in one language will use a masculine and in the other will use a feminine. For example, the word for bridge is El Puente in Spanish and it's Die Brücke in German. And in the 90s, there was some research that showed that people do think differently about a bridge or any other such item that is not, you know, that doesn't have a gender, but you think differently about it. And Spanish and German people will actually think differently about things, inanimate things, based on whether or on their gender. Of course, we don't have this in English, so we don't have to worry about this. Mark Twain famously talked about in a very funny essay called The Awful German Language. He picked out certain genders that just seemed particularly wrong in German, like maidens, you know, young women who get the neuter.
Yeah, the neuter thing, that's a whole other thing.
And turnips are female.
But isn't gender in language doesn't really have to do with male and female? Isn't it sort of a discrete thing? We call it male and female and neuter, but it doesn't correspond to men and women.
Because we do call them male and female, whether or not they are male and female or whether they have any characteristics, it sets off a series of associations.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that was the idea of that particular research. Well, there is another piece of research that I just wanted to mention because this is new. It's got nothing to do with the Guy Deutscher piece, but it does have something to do with the German language. It's actually, this is out of the University of Gothenburg. This is
really?
Yeah.
Oh, geez, and like, but it's about 8 million students there.
Personal nouns. So in order, you know, teacher. Now, in English, we just say teacher. There's nothing inherent in the language that suggests whether it's a male or a female. That's not the case in German, as in a lot of other languages. But in German, a lot of people have been trying to change and to be a bit more PC about this in the past few decades. And so he took a look at that, and he found that with feminist magazines that started making changes and splitting the forms, so they would, instead of saying Dear Reader, for example, if they were going to do a little Dear Reader thing, they would do Dear Reader and Readeress, which doesn't make a lot of sense in English.
Okay, I'd just like to redress the notion of using Readeress, okay?
Right.
It's wrong.
Well, what he found was that even the most diligent of these magazines would not get it right. I mean, they would still, the male stuff would kind of creep in. Sometimes they would use the male words, the male versions of the, you know, professor or teacher or what have you, they would use it in a sort of to indicate distance or disdain. But sometimes it would just creep in anyway. He says you can't, language always won out in the end. So our attempts to turn the language into either gender neutral or all inclusive failed.
Well, I think one of the problems that was always inherent in trying to neutralize language is that particularly around like proper names, they're all patrilineal to start.
Yeah.
So how do you even get going?
I know. It's tough. Yeah. I have a pet peeve myself. I don't like talking about pet peeves because, well,
they're, is it the word pet peeve or just the pet peeve?
Well, actually, the word is horrible, isn't it? But yeah. But even that, I don't like talking about that because this podcast is not supposed to be a sort of like, you got it wrong and grammar and all that. But I will go for this one. I do not like it when people talk about chairperson or spokesperson. Okay, because nearly always when they do, what they mean is chairwoman or spokeswoman.
Yes.
And they're using it because they don't want to use chairman because it's a woman, which is fine. But why don't they just say chairwoman? There's no need to say spokesperson. A spokesperson said, yeah, it's ridiculous.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
you know, just spokesman and spokeswoman. There are two, you know, we have two sexes on this earth, and let's use those two sexes. There's no need to be, you know, non-specific when we can be more specific.
I think it's fine. I think chairwoman, spokeswoman. I don't get it either.
Oh, I feel so much better now.
Oh, good. Let's just not even go down the road of the word partner.
Oh, no, no,
we'll
no.
save that from rant.
Yeah. So for story number three, because our friend Clark Boyd couldn't actually be with us in person because, Clark, you're in Brussels.
Researching beer, I think.
Yeah, he's spending most of his time researching
for
beer.
For a real story.
For a story. I mean, for a documentary. Instead of his being here, I thought I'd just play a story that he's done about the latest iteration of the Belgian language thing, which we talked about before in the pod. But this is a kind of a nice one. Because, well, maybe I should just say, for latecomers, that Belgium is divided between Dutch speakers and French speakers, with a few German speakers on the side. But basically, the country is kind of cracking up linguistically and politically. The language is the tail that is wagging the political and constitutional dog. But anyway, Clark found some Belgians who actually had enough of all of this serious stuff and had created an animated web video that shined a kind of more of a humorous light on it. So here goes.
Filmmaker Jérôme de Gerlache says when he grew up in Brussels, he hung out with Dutch and French-speaking friends. Language, culture, and politics weren't an issue. A few years ago, de Gerlache moved to Paris, and he started to get news from home about linguistic and political tensions threatening to rip his country apart. De Gerlache says people began asking him, so what's the deal with Belgium?
I felt like I had to do something because it was both terrible but also very funny because it's very surrealistic situation there.
De Gerlache decided to play with that situation.
That's what people like about Belgium when I'm introducing myself as Belgium. We are able to laugh about themselves, about ourselves, and just, okay, we are not taking us seriously, you know?
So he decided to make a short animated film. It's called Do You Want to Know More About Belgium?
Belgium has the reputation of being the dullest country in the world, inhabited only by friendly people who eat mussels with French fries and mayonnaise and produce Swiss chocolate.
De Gerlache says he wanted to use humor to hook his audience and poke fun at the, well, more curious aspects of the Belgian political structure.
For over 150 years, Belgium has produced the best experts in engineering the most inefficient political structure. Belgium excels at making everything as complicated as possible in their three national languages, Dutch, French, and German. They have one central government. Then, they have three regions, each with a government that has as much power as the central government. This is a very good way to make running the country totally impossible.
Obviously, I showed the bad side of the Belgian structure.
That's author and columnist Marcel Sell. Sell wrote the script for the short film, which has had more than 250,000 views online. Bart Brinkman is the chief political editor for the leading Flemish daily, De Standard. He thinks Do You Want to Know More About Belgium is funny, but he also thinks it glosses over a very important philosophical divide between the Flemish and the French-speaking Walloons. It comes down to this. The Flemish think that if you live in Flanders, you should speak Dutch. That's the law of the land. Belgium's French speakers, on the other hand, think that they should be able to speak French no matter where they live. And that, Brinkman says, is what makes these compromises so hard.
I think Belgium is a very, very complicated country. But the things are working here because, there are two communities, two different languages, and we try to cooperate together. And that's not easy to cooperate, but we manage.
In the film, the narrator notes that despite everything being catastrophically complicated here, Belgians can't live together, but they can't live apart. That's been tested in recent weeks, though. Even some in French-speaking Wallonia have started to openly wonder if they should get ready for the dissolution of Belgium. Director Jérôme de Gerlache says that fear is spreading.
People in Europe and in the world are afraid for Belgium. Because I don't know why people like Belgium as a whole. Really. And people are deeply sad when they think that Belgium is going to split. Everybody's kind of afraid that Belgium is going to disappear, no? And trying to inform them that there is still Belgium who like Belgium and who want Belgium to keep in one piece is what's important for me.
One thing both sides seem to agree on, it's better to be trying to work this out through negotiations instead of through bloodshed. Even the leader of the Flemish Nationalist Party, which wants an independent Flanders, told reporters last week, look, it's not like we're the Hutus and the Tutsis. Many here who want to keep Belgium united aren't sure whether to laugh or cry at that remark. For The World, this is Clark Boyd in Brussels.
Well, Clark, thank you very much. Sorry you couldn't be here. Is it Clark who's looking after Kevin the Second? You miss Kevin the Second.
Kevin the Second.
Oh, you'll have to listen to a form of a pod when I did with Clark and Ritu and a doll called Kevin the Second. I think Clark and Kevin the Second are over there glugging Belgian beer as we speak. Thank you, Clark. All right, on to story number two.
Story number two is kind of cool. Now, I know there's a big story out of northern India about a new language, an entire new language kind of found in the Himalayas.
Yeah.
Big news, but we're not going to talk about that.
Oh, that's great. I love it when we don't talk about stories.
We're talking about Tamil pulp fiction. There's a new collection of Tamil pulp fiction, and it's being translated into English. And the people who got involved in this, they have a sort of, I assume this is a native Tamil speaker, but the person is a math scholar from California. Hmm. And he found another Tamil who was from Chennai. They put together this publishing company, and they've published their first collection in English. And on the title, it says things like, mad scientists, hard-boiled detectives, vengeful goddesses, murderous robots, scandalous starlets. And the image on the cover is a bespectacled Tamil girl with a neatly braided in a seductive pose, wearing a sari and holding a gun.
That sounds very Bollywood.
And so what these people felt was that growing up, they would see these titles in train stations and wherever, and they were always intrigued. Mm. And they think that pulp fiction, Tamil or otherwise, in this case Tamil, is kind of a secret delight of all Indians, of all classes, and that there's kind of a democratizing effect of pulp fiction because everybody likes it. And they may not be honest about it or open, but they like it. And so they're trying to introduce this form to an English-speaking audience. So they found a great translator, and they're publishing like their second collection, and they may move on to other local languages in India and publish their pulp fiction. And part of their interest was also that a lot of what's written about India is kind of an English view of India, an old kind of colonial view of India about immigration, this or blah, 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 that. And they wanted to kind of to get a different side of India and Tamil-speaking India and look at these kind of racy, sort of almost bodice ripper kind of stories.
Well, that's interesting, yeah, because, I mean, as you say, you know, the English have sort of co-opted Indian stories. In a way, this is Indians co-opting at least an American genre and to their own ends,
yes.
Turning it around.
Yeah.
And is this audience, this English-speaking audience, is this an Indian-based English-speaking audience, or is this beyond India in the general English-speaking world?
It's both. Hmm. I think initially India, but there's also so many overseas Indians and overseas Tamil speakers that they're publishing it and making it available in those kind of countries, you know, like Toronto or, you know, wherever.
Right.
One of the other kind of interesting things about it is that Tamil is a particularly onomatopoetic language.
Oh, it
and,
is. Oh.
Yeah, so that's kind of a thing they have fun with. And, you know, our onomatopoeia, you know, bubbling brook, mm-hmm. you know, roar, oink, meow. You know, we've got a lot of onomatopoeia in English, but they have, here's a couple examples of onomatopoeia in Tamil. Vishk.
What does that mean?
The sound of a whip cracking.
Oh, that's awesome.
Danang, sound of a bell. Plick, that's spit landing on a wall.
Ooh, that's then, hard. That's
and
so.
And here's another one, labak. That's the sound of a purse being snatched. And they also, so they use these terms and they keep them in the English language.
Oh,
versions.
I'm glad to hear it. That makes it almost worth reading. Yeah.
Yes, and they also keep terms, food terms, things that are peculiarly Tamil. Mm. So they'll use idlis, which means rice cakes. Mm-hmm. So they'll use the local terms.
Right.
Because, you know, let's face it, that's how a lot of local terms in,
right.
I don't know, that's kind of how
right.
it goes.
Right.
They want to branch out into other languages, and they've already are in the middle of doing a Hindi Pulp Fiction.
Right.
And it's going to be called Heroes, Gundas, Vamps, and Good Girls.
Oh, that sounds awesome. I mean, if you think of how sort of Bollywood has stormed around the world and have been so successful, this sounds like a similar vein of deep storytelling, very highly evocative. Mm-hmm. I mean, it could really go places.
Yeah, and they're kind of, you know, a highly dramatic or melodramatic story around, you know, somebody with a violent husband, she's trying to move away. Or here's a funny, in the Tamil one, a funny sort of storyline is a short story about a female astronaut sabotaging an experiment meant to determine whether she and her husband could conceive in outer space. I do not want my child to be born like some guinea pig in a laboratory without my family around me.
Oh, that's great.
What?
Oh, that's great. Oh, boy. That's crazy. That reminds me of a very different part of India, but Bengali theater in I went to a theater performance in a village a few hours drive outside of Calcutta. And this style of theater, this genre of theater is called Jatra. And they had the craziest storylines. I mean, this one that I went to, I actually did a story on it. Maybe I should put it in the pod. It was on some evil people who had put acid, LSD, into the soda, Coca-Cola soda supply. And so all of the young people of India were being turned into like acid heads and
wow,
yeah, I mean, it was crazy.
That's kind of like right out of left field.
Oh,
like,
it was
what?
Just something else. I think the evil, the villains were Pakistanis.
You know? Of course.
That's the only thing that wasn't out of left field. Wow, that's great, Carol. I can't wait to get my hands on one of those.
Yeah, it's kind of cool. It's kind of cool. Yeah. So.
Okay. Well, on to story number one, and I know again that a fair degree has been written about these, but these genius grants that the MacArthur Foundation made, what, last month, there were a couple of really interesting language recipients. Well, in fact, there were three. I'll just mention one to start off with, and that was Eun Lee, who's
yes.
Chinese writer who writes in English, who you, Carol, did a profile of. That
yes,
was in,
and we both know her work well, and we've both spoken to her. And
yeah, great stuff. That's in The World in Words 46, if anyone wants to check that out. And she talks about writing in a language that is not her own, her mother tongue. For now, I wanted to focus on the two linguist recipients of these MacArthur Fellowships. These are, by the way, these are grants of $500,000.
It's a lot of money.
And you can spend the money on whatever you want. I mean, you can get new plumbing for your home if you want. It's just completely up to you. The first linguist who received one is Jessie Little Dobert. She is a member of the Wampanoag tribe here in Massachusetts. Yes. Wampanoag is a language that she became interested in. It's an extinct language. And she became interested in it after she had a dream in which her ancestors spoke to her in what she was convinced was the language. And she sort of made it her objective after that to learn the language and then eventually to try to revive it. So what she did was she was working at the time on Cape Cod as a social worker.
Huh.
And she got herself to MIT and studied under a famous linguist there. Together, they wrote an English Wampanoag dictionary based on, there was a huge amount of documents in Wampanoag from back in the Pilgrims days, right up until the time in the 19th century when it went extinct. It was originally used for missionary purposes to convert the tribes. So the Bible was translated into Wampanoag and various other documents. There's a huge number of documents there. So, you know, there was a lot of raw material. Anyway, from that, she founded something called the Wampanoag Language Reclamation Project. She's been doing a lot of work in trying to get members of her tribe at least interested enough in the language so they can, firstly, understand a little bit more of their history, and secondly, maybe introduce it in schools.
Wow.
And she says that she's going to spend some of the money on a school program for young members of the tribe. Yeah, I mean, it's incredible. I mean, this is a person who, until quite late in her life, I think in her 30s or something like that, language played no part in her life. And
can she speak it now?
She can speak it. And she says she has a daughter who, as far as she knows, this is a six-year-old girl, she's the only child since the 19th century raised from birth to speak Wampanoag.
Wow.
I mean, it's unbelievable.
I'm curious how she has learned Wampanoag and how it sounds to her when she speaks it is the way it sounded to her when her... in her dream.
Yeah, right. Or the way it was spoken back
exactly.
in the day.
Who knows?
Yeah.
So it's weird. Like, the language fades out in the 19th century, so there's no recordings.
No. Guesswork.
There's no example. Yeah. There's nothing. We don't know.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
Yeah. I mean, because it's part of the Algonquin family of languages, not all of which are extinct, then there are clues. There are a lot of clues.
Is she finding support among other Wampanoags? Is it something that everybody's proud and excited?
Oh, there's great pride in this, yeah. And the other linguist to have received a genius grant was Carol Padden, who's a University of California, San Diego professor who's worked on sign languages.
Hmm.
She signs herself, actually. And her big research, I mean, there have been a couple of areas of her research that have been groundbreaking. One is she has established that a lot of sign languages have grammatical structures, even, you know, when they're not spoken or written, but signed. And even at the beginning of their development, they still have sophisticated grammatical structure.
So that's incredible.
Yeah. One of the languages that she focused on was the Al Said Bedouin Sign Language, which has developed over the past 70 years. So it's relatively young, in a village in southern Israel.
That's amazing.
Yeah. It's incredible.
Because I used to think that sign language was sign language. I never dawned on me till a few podcasts ago or whenever we talked about this last time that sign language, each one is kind of discrete, sort of for obvious reasons.
Right.
Because it's signing a different language.
Right. And there's a lot of controversy around people who try to universalize these sign languages. It's the same thing that we have with spoken languages is, you know, there are dominant ones and there are less dominant ones. And there are thoughts that some people have, but wouldn't it be easier if, you know, if
it's
everyone
like the Esperanto
spoke the same?
People. Just don't go there. It's just not going to work.
Esperanto, sign Esperanto. Now you've raised that, it makes me wonder whether there's Esperanto sign. I bet there is. Yeah, so that's Carol Padden, another genius.
But it's also, to me, very telling that the two genius grants this year go to people involved in languages.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, that this happens over and over again, and I think you see it weekly in the work you do. But it is amazing how the role of the web, the internet in this is huge.
Yeah.
I mean, when I was in Sweden talking to these African authors, many of whom speak many languages, you know, one of them is just writing in his local language now.
Mm.
And they see the web as this just total boon to their local languages. It just opened this whole other world. And who would have ever thought?
Wow. Well, on that amazing note, thank you very much, Carol. Nice to have you back here from the chilly northern climes.
Thanks, Patrick. Always a pleasure.
And how are the cartoons doing?
They're doing great. They're doing great. This week, we have a lot of sort of plays on Blue Danube, now red, because of the horrible toxic spill in Hungary.
Yeah, the sludge.
And, yes. And we've got a lot of, you know, it's a somewhat old story now, but the kind of newly anointed Kim Jong-il's son.
Oh, Kim Jong-un.
Kim Jong-un. A lot of funny cartoons around him. I guess it's not so funny if you're in North Korea, but the cartoonists are having fun with him kind of bestowing leadership on really God knows what.
Well, I look forward to seeing that and talk to you soon.
All right.
I'll post links of related material at theworld.org/language, also at patrickcox.wordpress.com. You can post your comments at the World in Words Facebook group page or tweet me. My handle is Patrick Cox, PatriCox. Or email me. The address is language@pri.org. You can see Carol's cartoon slideshows at theworld.org/cartoons. Next week, I'll be out in the field. It's the season, right? Apple picking and all of that. Well, I'll be plucking some linguistic fruit. Ooh, sounds nasty. So, a new pod in 2 weeks. Talk then.